This is Education Matters, and if you'd like to listen to this entire discussion, you may access it in the archives of our webpage at WGTD.org. My guests today were Harborside Academy Assistant Principal Trent Barnhart and Harborside Seniors Cordell Sulamoyo, Kimmy Lintz, and Natalie Pitts telling us about their senior projects from which they just returned. Thank you all for sharing these profound experiences with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, celebrating its 85th season with its annual gala at Wingspread, Saturday, August 6th. It's an evening of music, elegant hors d'oeuvres, and beverages against the serene backdrop of the Wingspread landscape. To reserve a seat or a table, call 636-9285.
This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
I'm Jim McClure. Our guest this week is Dan Kaler, Director of Tours and Special Programs at the University of Chicago's Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay. Dan, summertime at the observatory sure takes on a different character when I pulled up, starting with sometimes it's hard to find a place to park.
Well, summer is our big season here. We have a lot of visitors, so we currently have tours at 10 a.m., 11 a.m., and 2 p.m., so we have a lot of tourists coming through. We also are starting to develop a specialty tour for our telescope programs in the afternoon at 2:30. So we'll be taking people to see the telescopes, all three of our large instruments, and then also doing a walk-around tour of the architecture. So at 2:30 in the afternoon, starting about June 21st or so, we'll be doing those additional tours in the later afternoon of the building. Those are things we've never done before.
The children seem to be out in high number too.
Yerkes Educational Outreach, which is another division of the observatory, is conducting six camps for summer camps for children in grades three and four, 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. So they're doing two different types of programs for each of those grade groups this year. Normally, we have been doing four camps a year. This year, it's been expanded to six. Yerkes Educational Outreach is really taking a foothold here at the observatory and really doing a lot of new work, especially with their teachers and then also with the children themselves. So there are tech camps going on, so it's not just about astronomy. There are a couple of camps having to do with Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, specifically in astronomy, but others of these camps deal strictly with technology topics.
Do you have any of the mix sometimes of some students that are back from college working on their master's or their undergrad projects?
We don't have a lot of students from campus working here right now. We do actually have a brand new, it's called the Metcalf Scholarship Program. There was a large grant that was given to the university earlier this year to initiate internships for first-year students at the University of Chicago to work in different areas associated with the university. And we actually have 8 of those interns here this year, this summer. So they're living on the grounds. They're working with us in Yerkes Educational Outreach Programs. One is working with me in the tours area. She's actually been assigned by us a project to rewrite the booklet that describes the observatory that we sell in our gift shop. So we're coming out with a new version of that booklet, and it's going to be expanded to include more of the current programs that are done here at the observatory, that are conducted here at the observatory, and then also things that have been done in the past here as well. So she's working on that project for me. But others are working on, mostly with Yerkes Educational Outreach, they have stints that they'll be handling in our front office, so they get to answer the telephone, they get to do some of those mundane things, those things that have to be taken care of that are very important, working in our gift shop, doing some accounting work for us and so on. So they're getting a wide field view of the entire operation here at the observatory.
You mentioned that summer is often the time of the Milky Way. Why is that?
Well, the Milky Way for Northern Hemisphere observers is well placed in the months of July, August, September. It's basically directly overhead. In the evening, as the sun is setting, we see this milky, hazy band of light that stretches from north to south and then just kind of rotates right over the top of us as the evening progresses, and then we see it over in the western sky as the evening ends. And that is that hazy band of light that's composed of millions upon millions upon millions of stars that are distant. They're part of our galaxy, but they're pretty distant from where we are located. We're looking at individual arms of the spiral of our Milky Way when we look into that band. So it's kind of tough for us to understand what our galaxy looks like because we're on the inside of it. And as a matter of fact, the spiral structure of the Milky Way galaxy, that particular discovery was made here at the observatory in the late 1940s and early 1950s by William Wilson Morgan, one of our directors. He was an astronomer at that time. He became one of our directors later on here at the observatory. And using the 40-inch refractor and a specialized spectrograph, he was able to look at the spectra of individual bright blue stars that were scattered around our galaxy. And a simplified explanation of that is just simply he understood that those were assembled in a spiral pattern around the galaxy, and from that trace began tracing out the arms of the Milky Way that way. So up until the middle part of the 20th century, we didn't know necessarily that we lived in a spiral galaxy. That had been assumed or presumed, suspected, but it wasn't known for sure. In the early 1950s, Bill Morgan settled that question definitively. So we do live in a spiral galaxy. So we are in one spiral arm looking across the plane of our galaxy into other spiral arms, and they collectively look like this very long band of milky white that stretches from north to south. And it's well placed for Northern Hemisphere observers during the summer.
The 100th year, 2016, I think back, wasn't 1916 when Edwin Hubble at least got his undergraduate degree, wasn't it?
Hubble earned his PhD here in 1917. Okay. So near the time of the end of the First World War, and worked here. He had previously been an attorney, as a matter of fact, so he had already been working professionally and decided to switch careers. So he was an older fellow when he earned his PhD, but he did that work here at the Yerkes Observatory from about 1915 until 1917. So 1916, 100 years ago, would have been right in the middle of his term here at the observatory working with the 40-inch refractor. When he left in 1917, he joined George Ellery Hale, our first observatory director here, who had moved on and founded the Mount Wilson Observatory in Southern California. He worked with Hale beginning almost immediately after the beginning of the use of the 100-inch reflecting telescope there. It's called the Hooker Reflector, and that telescope still operates today. It's not used for astronomical research work, but it's still being used for different purposes today. And that is the telescope that that Hubble used to discover the expansion of the universe, so that all the galaxies are moving away from us. That was a discovery that he made with that telescope, which eventually led others to the Big Bang Theory. So it was an extremely important discovery at that time, the expansion of the galaxy, the expansion of the universe. But the individual little galaxies that people didn't necessarily understand that's what they were looking at, and they had been viewing those through smaller instruments for a period of about 200 years or so. They were referred to as spiral nebulae. And it was Hubble who basically definitively explained to us and really discovered that each of those little spiral nebulae, which up until that point were considered to be part of the Milky Way, to be structures in our own galaxy, turn out to be galaxies all onto their own.
A little thing about architecture, maybe want to run this by Richard, but I was reading about how the individual houses around here all have kind of their own stories, And yet, in some cases, they shared the university's architect. That Cobb apparently discovered a couple of those.
Well, yes. Henry Ives Cobb designed the observatory. He also designed 16 buildings for the original campus that we call the Quad now, the Quadrangle on campus. He designed those buildings as well. A few of the buildings up here that are exterior to the building, to the main building itself, specifically two of the homes here, the assistant director's house and the director's home, were both designed by Henry Ives Cobb.
You know, it's interesting because you would think that most of his work was with large buildings and institutional things, and yet he got to try his hand at, home architecture.
Well, Henry Ives Cobb was a prolific architect, and he's really not given the credit that he should have, received. He was not particularly good at marketing his legacy. People like Daniel Burnham, John Root, Louis Sullivan, and Frank Lloyd Wright, who is a household name as far as architects is concerned, those fellows were able to create a legacy for themselves because of the way that they marketed their names, the way that they marketed their products. Henry Ives Cobb just cranked out lots and lots of buildings, and he did it extremely well and was extraordinarily efficient. He actually had a firm at one point of 120 associates working in Chicago. He's one of the busiest architects in the city, and in the Midwest for that matter. So you don't hear a lot about Henry Ives Cobb, but a lot of people know his buildings. For example, the Newberry Library on Washington Square in Chicago is probably his most famous commission that's still standing. But the original, what we would call the original Palmer House, which was the home that Powder and Bertha Palmer lived in, and Bertha Palmer became the great receptionist, so to speak, in the city of Chicago. Anyone who came to Chicago wound up at Bertha's home, which was in the 1200 block of North Lakeshore Drive at that time. And it was a 53-room castle, essentially. It was like a Renaissance castle that Henry Ives Cobb designed. Bertha had that house designed with no locks, no keys, key locks or keyholes, and no exterior doorknobs. So you had to be admitted to her home. So she decided whether or not she got in her house, and Henry Ives Cobb designed that little detail for her. So she had a continuous group of servants working in that house. That house was raised in 1950, so it no longer stands. But people can go online and see photographs of it. There were postcards that were done of it. Probably his most elaborate building, but he did design homes, and he designed quite a few that are still standing. The old, what Chicago residents call the old post office, which was really the federal building, the new federal building sits on that spot today. But the old post office, the old federal building, was one of his biggest commissions in Chicago as well. A great building that has just come back, that had been not necessarily abandoned, but was not being used, was a Chicago Athletic Association building. It's now a boutique hotel, and it is kitty-corner from the Art Institute on South Michigan. And it's a beautiful old building. It's been completely renovated in the interior. That was one of his great commissions as well. So you will find buildings from Henry Ives Cobb all over Chicago, different cities in the Midwest. His largest commission was the Sinclair Oil Building in New York, about a 40 or so story skyscraper that he designed toward the end of his career in the 1920s. It was damaged in the attacks of 9/11. It's been completely renovated now too, and it's a luxury condominium from bottom to top. It's just a few blocks off of the World Trade Center area. So he did a broad variety of buildings. He also was a painter. He worked in watercolors and did a lot of scenes, New York scenes, after he retired. And those were scenes mostly from Central Park and different street scenes and so on. And it turns out, interestingly enough, that one of his great collectors, Henry Ives Cobb, died in 1931. One of his great collectors turned out to be Leona Helmsley, the Queen of Mean. And so when Leona Helmsley passed away some years ago, she's the lady who's responsible for the great phrase that taxes are just for the little people, and she was jailed on tax evasion charges. Anyway, when she passed away, her collection of artwork came up for auction. It was auctioned off, and there were a number of Henry Ives Cobb paintings in that collection. So, and they didn't go for huge amounts of money. They were probably on the order of $50,000 to $100,000, but that's not too bad for a painting from an architect or a painter who's kind of been lost to history. We would certainly love to have had one of his paintings here at the observatory. But he also had a son, Henry Abscop Jr., who was an artist and architect like his father. Henry Abscop Jr. has a number of fairly well-known paintings that are out in collections as well. So very talented people, very creative people. There's certain mystery that surrounds Cobb, because when he died in 1931, he decided that he wanted all of his work destroyed, any notes, papers, records, details about any of the projects that he worked on. Just simply didn't want any of that sitting around. Whether it was because he didn't want to be copied, or he didn't want, there were some secrets involved in those notes and those papers or whatever, but he asked his son, Henry Abscop Jr., to destroy all of his work upon his death. And unfortunately for us, the son obliged him. And so we have no archive to go back to. That's one of the difficult things about understanding some of the architectural details here at the observatory. So we really don't have an archive of drawings from Henry Abscop to go back to. We have great drawings of the floor plan, of the plumbing, of the electrical, all of those things. Yes, we have all of that, but the exact architectural details, the things like the terracotta inside and the cast plaster, terracotta outside, or the cast plaster inside, we just simply don't have any details on those.
Yeah, there must have been at some point sketches of what each one of those things was going to be.
Well, it has recently come to light, and it's taken us a number of years of effort to do this. And our guests who come here, our visitors who come here, who look at it, oftentimes clue us into things that we haven't really examined real closely and that we haven't really thought of. It turns out that in the 19th century, apparently, there were four books that a lot of architects worked out of to get their artistic, shall we say, their artistic inspirations from. Mm-hmm. And we have checked on one of those. It is called Grammar of Ornament. And we've seen a few pieces in Grammar of Ornament that we can identify with the observatory. There are three other books that we're going to be examining. It turns out that a lot of architects use those books. And what those books are composed of are drawings of architectural details from that are around all around Europe in different buildings from the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries. So we can either find the influence that was paramount in the design of this building, or we can find the exact details in those books. So the mystery of what these things are might be becoming unlocked gradually over the course of the next year or so. And we'll be able to tell visitors more about what they're exactly looking at. But we often have thought that most of what we were looking at were original designs. Perhaps that's not the case. Perhaps they're adaptations of things that you might find elsewhere in Europe or could have found in European buildings a long time ago. They might be direct ripoffs, too, that it's entirely possible that that's what it is. But we suspect that Henry Abscop probably did not exactly sit down and draw all of these things, that he had a staff that would have done that, mm-hmm. and maybe he gave them a certain amount of artistic license to do as they pleased, and the end result is what you see here at the observatory, because it is I often say an outrageously elaborate building. It's spectacularly beautiful, very, very, very unique. It's just a building like you will not find anywhere else. And we're often asked to interpret the symbols, or do we understand exactly what we're looking at, and can we tell a story? Certain things are very easy for us to figure out. Other things are next to impossible for us to understand. And the juxtaposition, the positioning of certain features next to each other and in the same groupings, different symbols in the same groupings that we try to weave a story around, or we try to understand why those things might have been put together. It may be nothing more than just it was a great way to decorate the building. So we might be trying too hard to figure some of these things out, but that's Cobb was certainly brilliant, and he certainly built a beautiful observatory, and it is still standing 120 years after construction was completed. So we're very grateful for the work that Cobb did on the building. And the elaborateness just adds to the whole aura of the place, and it's a great and fun place to be and to work and to do celestial observing.
How are the houses holding up? They're still inhabited in most cases.
Many of the homes here are not being used currently. Some of them are, many of them are not. And there is a there are some decisions that are going to have to be made on the disposition, you know, of the homes. University is not inclined to sell any of the properties, so we may see that some of those homes coming down. Others of them, the greatest home on the property is the director's home. It was built for George Ellery Hale and designed by Henry Ives Cobb. It was a great social center for the visitors who came from the city and from other universities. Lots of dinners were held there. People stayed overnight. It's a huge old home. It's a right now it's set up for four huge bedrooms and several bathrooms, a couple of fireplaces, sitting rooms and parlors and so on, a huge dining room, a very nice sized kitchen. That house is currently vacant, and there are plans to have that renovated and restored and probably used for a number of different purposes, some of which revolves around Yerkes Educational Outreach as a meeting center. Some of it for office space, potentially, some of it for some of us who stay here overnight. I live some distance away from the observatory, so, and I observe very late. Some of my programs run very late, so it would be great to have a place to crash. I can do that here in the building, but it would be much more comfortable to have a bed in a real house with a bathroom right next door. So we're looking at doing something like that with that home. The assistant director's house, which is just to the north of the director's house, is occupied now. Our director of Yerkes Educational Outreach is using that one. Our interns are staying in what we call the Struve house, which is a little cottage that is to the south and slightly the west of the director's home. Just beyond that is the Barnard house, which one of our former directors is using currently. So those are the four main homes. We have one that is being privately rented right now, has been for a number of years, but that's not something that the university is not crazy about being a landlord. So that is not something that we're going to see happen with some of the other homes. One of our accounting people lives in one of the small houses right on the highway right now, so she rents that one. But several of the others are vacant at this point and probably will stay that way.
And you're listening to Community Matters on WGTD-FM in Racine, Kenosha, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. With me, Dan Kaler, tour director at the Yerkes Observatory.
Some work was done on the main dome.
We had a problem with the shutter of the dome. That's the opening that the telescope looks through. It's like a doorway or a window. And it is a metal structure, two doors that slide on rails. On I-beams, basically. There's an I-beam at the top of the dome, one at the bottom of the dome. So those doors slide open. They split right down the middle, so there's a seam in the center. One door slides to the right, the other to the left. For several years now, they have been out of alignment, and that is something that is just kind of natural for that thing, for that type of structure to happen. And there were some broken welds at the top of the shutter mechanism that were not pulling it tightly together. You could potentially see a little daylight through it. We weren't having a water problem, but they definitely were not closing properly. We just got done in mid-June with a repair project that was long overdue to get that shutter back aligned properly, to close properly. There was a great degree of welding that was required and new parts that needed to be installed, and we used some of the old 1896 parts. The dome was actually completed in 1896, so some parts were taken off. They were reworked and put back into place again, reinforced, and that shutter works beautifully. Again, used to squeak like crazy and no longer makes any noise. It's almost perfectly silent when it opens and closes now. So the telescope, which was down for a couple of weeks because the shutter could not be used, and we could not turn the telescope because we had a lot of equipment on the main observing floor that was assisting with the repair of that shutter. That's all been taken out, and the telescope is back in operation again.
The refractor is seeing more use than it has in previous years. Now that you've opened it up more for public access, but what are people discovering?
Well, I always, people ask me the difference between looking through the 40-inch refractor and looking through the 24-inch reflector, and both of those telescopes are available for public viewing now, and people just simply need to go out to our website. We have a link to a page that shows you the dates and the times of public viewing, and reservations are required for that, and there is a fee for observing. Last year, I registered 1,600 people for the 24-inch program. So it was, and about half of those people actually got clear nights and got to view. Unfortunately, if we have cloudy evenings, we can't really do a whole lot with our telescopes. And about 50% of our evenings here turn out to be cloudy. So now that we have opened the 40-inch refractor to public viewing, and I've been involved in astronomy for a little over 40 years as an amateur, probably either a professional amateur or an amateur professional. You take your pick on that. So I've been using smaller telescopes for many, many years. The 24-inch was actually the largest scope that I had used on a regular basis up until last year. I'm rediscovering things that I have looked at for over four decades now, seeing them in a whole new circumstance, in a whole new light. There's detail there to be seen visually that, generally speaking, I've only ever seen photographically. Long exposure photographs are able to build up an image and show us more detail. Can actually see quite a bit of that detail visually that I'm accustomed to seeing only in a picture. So there's a huge difference between the refractor and the reflector as far as resolution is concerned, the brightness of the object, how much detail we can see. The 24-inch is a beautiful instrument for most people. That's going to be the largest telescope that they're going to look through, and it's always going to give them a fantastic view. For anybody who wants to see some of these objects that we look at regular basis in all of their full glory, about as good as we can possibly make it, at least in this part of the country, with an astronomical telescope, the 40-inch refractor is the one to look through.
Can you point it right at the moon and see the moon?
Oh, and the moon is... I'm not actually ever really been a lunar observer, because for me, I'm a deep sky observer. I like to look at things like galaxies and planetary nebulae and emission nebulae and galaxies and so on. I like to look at what we refer to as deep sky objects. They're fainter, much fainter objects, and their light has a difficult time competing with moonlight. So as we get closer to full moon, generally speaking, we don't use the telescopes to look at those fainter objects. So for me, the moon has always been the world's greatest light polluter. And it's around every single month, so we always have to, we always have to plan our observing schedules around it. Starting with the refractors, one of the first things that we looked at with the refractor after we converted it from its old photographic use to a visual telescope last fall, I have to say that I was very, very pleasantly surprised by the view that we're getting of the moon and surface details that I only gave a passing glance to. We have some very good lunar atlases here. I can take a page from a lunar atlas, hold it up next to the eyepiece, and look back and forth and see virtually every single detail that's on that lunar atlas. And those atlases are generally created by, or were created by, observers who worked at the telescope under high magnification over the course of many years to identify each one of those individual details. Nowadays, we can send a lunar orbiter to the, in fact, the moon has been completely mapped front and back by lunar orbiters. And so we have extremely detailed photographs, extremely detailed atlases of lunar features. But the atlases that we're using here are generally made by visual observers on Earth, not from a lunar spacecraft. And it's just stunning, the amount of detail that you can see visually through the refractor, that you can identify each and every single one of those individual items, each one of those little features in the eyepiece of the telescope. It's pretty fantastic to see.
This time of year, you've got a unique alignment of several planets. What are the three main planets that you see now?
February and March gave us our best views of Jupiter. Jupiter has now, from our perspective, the Earth's position around the sun now appears to be fairly far to the west as evening sets in. So we're pretty much past prime as far as our Jupiter viewing is concerned. We can look at it with telescopes, but nearly as interesting to look at as it was, say, 4 months ago. So it's still visible, and it's something that we can still look at in telescopes. The next planet beyond that, or the next one to look at currently, is Mars, which is pretty much in the month of June, is pretty much straight south at sunset. It's that reddish-orange orb that we see in between the constellations of Scorpius and Sagittarius. It's low. It's not going to get any higher for us this year. It's on a low portion of what we call the ecliptic, which is the apparent path of the sun, the moon, and the planets. So an ecliptic traces out the plane of our solar system. So that is pretty much due south at sunset as darkness falls each evening in June and early July. And then about 45 minutes to the east of that, to the east of Mars, we will find Saturn. So it's unusual right now that we have the big three, as we call it, Jupiter, Mars, Saturn, in that order. Mars is closest to us once every 2 years. It was relatively close to us this year at approximately 44 million miles or so, which sounds like it's really far away, but it never gets any closer to us than 32 million miles. In 2018, in the fall of 2018, we'll have another nice close approach. It'll be 2 years from now. And Mars will come within about 35 million miles of us. So it will be closer, it'll be even brighter, and in a telescope will appear larger. Mars is the only planet that we can see a solid surface on. So that's why it's always very interesting for people to look at. And of course, according to folklore, War of the Worlds and all of that science fiction that's been written about Mars over the years, all the good and the bad, makes Mars a really interesting object for most people to want to see. It's one of the things that people ask to see when they come here to the observatory to look at through a telescope. Sometimes we can oblige that request, other times not, because Mars is very elusive. It's here for a while, it's visible for us for a while, and then for a great part of the time, it's very, very close to the sun. It's coming up way too late, it's setting way too early. It's too far away from us to discern into much more than a very, very small disk. So the Mars viewing period is usually relatively short. It's usually only a few months long, and it will end toward the end of July this year. And then we, about 2 years from now, we'll see Mars well again. So it's about that every two-year cycle.
Do you think we're going to get to Mars in our lifetime, and will we still be looking at it from your keys when we do?
I think Mars is always going to hold a great fascination for humans. I certainly hope that I live long enough to see somebody land on Mars, to see human exploration, physical human exploration of the planet. The cost factor, of course, is what's been prohibiting that from happening, and the danger that's involved in that. And I think there's plenty of people on Earth who would love to make that trip, regardless of what the circumstances may be for their getting back. So I think watching the movie The Martian, I think, has really activated a lot of people's imaginations, and perhaps that's going to be the impetus again to see that happen. By the way, the science on that movie was pretty darn good. It was pretty accurate. Except for one thing, the dust storm that causes all the problems at the beginning for Matt Damon's character, dust storms aren't quite that strong on Mars, wouldn't be quite that violent. So that's a little bit of Hollywood taking advantage of the fact that there are dust storms. There can be strong storms on Mars because it has an atmosphere, but the atmosphere is way too thin to produce that kind of effect. So that was a little bit of an exaggeration. But otherwise, all of the other things that they discuss in the physics, in the science, in the space technology, looks pretty darn accurate. And I was actually quite impressed with that movie. But I have a feeling that that may be something of an impetus to continue moving towards a manned mission to Mars. It's going to take a long time. It's going to take a year and a half or so to get there, a year and a half to get back. That's a long time for people to be away from Earth. That's something well beyond what humans have done. So it's going to be another huge step. I was just coming into my teen years when we landed on the moon, and we thought that was going to be pretty spectacular and nearly impossible. And it turned out to become very routine, so perhaps that exact same thing will happen with missions to Mars in the not-too-distant future.
Do you recall back in your teen years, was there a kind of a mini renaissance of sorts here at Yerkes? Were a lot of people coming to look at the moon back when we were starting to first land on the moon?
Well, actually, interestingly enough, Yerkes played an important role in figuring out the landing sites for the Apollo spacecraft. And that's something that people are not necessarily well aware of. There was one of our professors, and he actually worked here for quite a number of years. His name is Gerard Kuiper, or was Gerard Kuiper. And that name should be familiar to some people from the Kuiper Belt. Gerard Kuiper proposed that there were bodies very similar to the planet Pluto, much farther out in orbit around the sun than where Pluto is located, and that they were icy, rocky body composites, that they were not necessarily planet-like and not necessarily comet-like, but they were something in between. Now, beyond that, we have something called the Oort cloud, which Oort was another astronomer, Dutch, who proposed that there were ice bodies. There was a huge cloud of ice bodies surrounding the solar system, and that occasionally those got nudged in, either nudged into the sun or nudged away from the sun. And those bodies composed what we call comets today, and that turns out to be the case. And the Kuiper Belt turns out to be real, a real entity as well. So Pluto wound up being demoted, of course, because of the fact that there are other bodies very similar to it that are on highly elliptical orbits in a very congested, crowded area. So the term dwarf planet was coined to talk about or to explain what those types of bodies are. So the asteroid Ceres, for example, which is spherical in shape but resides in the asteroid belt, became a dwarf planet. So did Pluto. There's other dwarf planets called Sedna and Quaoar. So the International Astronomical Union in 2006 created this classification that we call dwarf planets. But the situation with the moon and Kuiper is a little bit different. What happened is Kuiper was working on a project. He was a planetary scientist, a planetary astronomer, was part of a NASA program to create a very detailed lunar atlas that NASA could use to figure out lunar landing sites that would be advantageous or safe for a potential manned mission to the moon. And that project actually started in the late 1950s and extended into the early 1960s. So it was approximately 3-4 years or so, and 5 observatories were involved in that, and they were the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, the Lick Observatory in Northern California near San Jose, the Mount Wilson Observatory near Los Angeles, Yerkes, and then an observatory in the Pyrenees Mountains in France. So under different lighting conditions and during different times of the year in its orbit, the moon was photographed by 5 different telescopes. And the composite images from those were put together in a 250-page, very large format atlas from which the Air Force and then later NASA used those pictures to figure out the Apollo landing sites. So that the Yerkes refractor was the telescope that was used for that program here at the observatory. So it actually contributed to our understanding about where great places would be to land on the moon. So when someone looks through the telescope, they're actually looking through the lenses that were used for this mapping program, which I think is pretty interesting.
Come third week of July, Wisconsin Farm Technology Days, all eyes will be on the southern part of Lake Geneva in the town of Lynn to learn about innovations in farming, but yet they're going to be learning about Yerkes as well.
Yeah, interestingly enough, one would not put Farm Technology Days and Yerkes together. However, the organizers are creating a scale model of the Geneva Lake, and it'll be on a football field-sized area, and they're going to put 6 different geographic points or points of interest around the lake, one of which is going to be the observatory. So we're going to have a station there to discuss. People will walk around it. Around the scale model of the lake, and they'll come and talk to us about the observatory and get some information, and hopefully we'll We'll have a lot of visitors during that time from Farm Technology Days, but we're looking forward to that. It's a completely different way for us to get our message out to the public.
You've been on the job full time since late fall, October, November of last year. How much of what you started to do have you set in motion here?
Well, it's amazing how much needed to be done. It's also amazing how much has been accomplished. The first main goal was to open the refractor for public viewing, and that program started in January. Our testing of the refractor for public viewing purposes started actually in October last year, and we were pretty successful with getting that program up and running, and we've had about 200 people go through the program already. So that's well ahead of the expectations that I had for this time period. So, and it turns out that it's the telescope that people are asking the most about. Now, that's a $100 per person program. It runs about 2 hours. We look at five or six different objects. The detail is outstanding, and there's just a lot to be seen. We limit that program to 12 to 14 individuals so that everybody gets an opportunity to spend a lot of time at the eyepiece. It takes a little bit of time to learn how to use a telescope. It's a big instrument, and there are some nuances to that one that need to be explained, and people need to test out their eyesight and understanding of how to focus it and so on. But I have not failed to have anybody figure it out yet. Everybody's been pretty wowed by what they've been seeing. We've done an extensive restructuring of our hallway displays. We've taken some old things down that have been up for way too long, and we have put up some brand new displays. I have three brand new boards that tell the story of the Hubble Space Telescope and some of the images that it's taken, both galaxies. Then there's one for nebulae, and then also one for something about the life cycle of stars. Spectacular images, and we're getting a lot of positive feedback from that. Another new display that's going up right now in the middle of June is a display about next year's total solar eclipse, which will occur on August 21st, 2017. The only landfall for that particular solar eclipse path is diagonally across the United States. So most Americans will have no more than half a day's drive, possibly as long as a day's drive, to get to the path of totality and for the first time in their lives see a total solar eclipse. It's being referred to as the Great American Eclipse because it is only touching the United States. And that is the first time since the country's founding in 1776 that something like that has happened. So we will have another opportunity in April of 2024. We'll have another eclipse track coming up from Mexico, crossing into Texas, and going out the northeastern part of the country. That'll happen in April of 2024. But this is the first one in the 21st century, and it's the first time since February 26th of 1979 that a total solar eclipse track has actually touched the continental United States. So it's been a long, long time coming. Those of us who saw that eclipse back in 1979 have been waiting for 2017 for an awful long time. I've seen eclipses in other countries on other continents, but I've been waiting to see one in my home country again, and we will have that opportunity next year. So we have a new display that's describing more about what to expect and how to view that eclipse. We have expanded our tour programs. We have something coming up now in toward the end of June. We'll have afternoon tours of all three telescopes. We'll have an opportunity for people to look through a 12-inch telescope. Provided the sky is clear, we'll be able to safely view the sun through some equipment that has been purchased for that purpose with a small telescope on the south lawn. We'll have another afternoon tour, walking tour about the architecture of the observatory. We have lots of new things in the gift shop. Our promotional literature has been rewritten. We have a new booklet that's in production explaining the history of the observatory and some of the important things that have been done here and what we're doing with the building and the facility today. We're working on that project right now. So we have had a tremendous amount of new things happening, things that have been long overdue that have needed to be done, making it a much greater place to visit.
So I would say your overall message to the public in conclusion is don't be shy, and you're not just a Saturday morning place to visit anymore.
Now, this is not the same place that it used to be. Yerkes is going to live on, and George Eller Hale, I think our first observatory director, would be very, very proud of the things that we're doing. He was a popularizer of astronomy in science in general in the 19th and early 20th centuries. I think he'd be very happy by the work that we're doing today with his observatory. Our telescopes are considered too small for research purposes, so they're no longer used for that. But they are extremely good instruments for using for the public to teach astronomy, using for grade school and high school students to inspire them to become astrophysicists and astronomers, to become scientists of other kinds, to go into engineering and technological.